welcome to Worlds Apart, promising to wipe out a whole civilization and asking for God's blessing for the great people of Iran. This now historic pose by President Trump seems to have set in motion a peacemaking process that may cool tensions in the Middle East for at least 2 weeks. Is it enough, though, to leave the realm of epic fury and create the conditions for normal, ordinary diplomacy? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Alam Saleh, senior lecturer in Iranian studies at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Professor Saleh, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we are recording this interview on Friday with the talks between Iran and the United States expected to commence on Saturday. Do you think the sides have had enough of war to value and respect this opening for a peaceful settlement?
Well, to start with, this war was unnecessary. It was the war of choice. It was the war illegal, of course, and everything could be sorted on the table in Geneva 41 days ago. Actually, as we have heard from diplomats, Arab diplomats and European diplomats, there were chances, good chances, for both sides to reach an agreement without entering this war. So apparently, President Trump was dragged into this war, making his probably biggest strategic mistake. Mm-hmm. And now he's going to Islamabad with much more difficult, files and issues to deal with. Mm-hmm. So there will be much more challenges to deal with in Islamabad than in Geneva 41 days ago.
Mm-hmm. I heard you say before that the United States was counting on a swift, decisive airborne victory while Iran was better positioned for a prolonged asymmetrical conflict. 6 weeks into that, where do you think they stand in terms of their strategies?
Well, I think Trump has been defeated three times before the war starts and three times after the war started. And that is because in 2018, he withdrew from the nuclear deal, hoping that the maximum pressure policy would lead Iran to surrender. This did not happen. And then in last summer, almost 9 months ago, United States and Israel invaded Iran, hoping that Iran would surrender and they would defeat Iran completely. But this did not happen too. And then he sent his troops and warships in the Indian Ocean and in the Mediterranean Sea, hoping that the Iranian diplomats would surrender before the war started in Geneva, and this did not happen. And that's why he said he was disappointed. Mm-hmm. But three times he was also defeated during the war. At the beginning, he had raised the expectations to see that a very quick and a swift and clean war that would end within days his aims were either regime change or the complete surrender, these are his own terms, or fully destroying Iran's military and also nuclear facilities. None of this has happened. And the second mistake after month of the war started was his strategies. He didn't have any strategy to follow the war. Mm-hmm. He soon after the war erupted, Iran was able to close the Strait of Hormuz. United States was not able to open it, mm-hmm. was not able to establish a coalition. Last mm-hmm. but not least, well, he reached a point that he had started to threat Iran with the war crimes, with targeting civilian facilities, and that is the last defeat. Mm-hmm. Finally, he agreed Iranian conditions to come to Islamabad to deal with issues that were not on the table in Geneva before the start mm-hmm. of the war.
Now, Professor, I'm sure President Trump would disagree with you on all those counts. And given his predilection for sort of imposing his own very rigid view on everything, it's very tempting to dismiss everything that he says as a bluff. But still, if we try to apply analytical lenses, how much damage has been done to Iran in your view?
Well, of course, there were a lot of tactical and material damages. United States is the greatest military power for sure, and joined by Israel and other great military power. And it's not a surprise that they were able to hit Iran so badly militarily. But this war was not about hitting Iranian and making the pain. It was about the strategic plans that none of them have mm-hmm. been achieved by United States and Israel. So strategically speaking, Iran actually won the war. But when it comes to the battle, the United States and Israel won. But when it comes to the war, it was Iran that achieved all its goals. Mm-hmm. Now, United States has no two bargaining powers as before. Sanctions and military threat, both of them mm-hmm. actually did not work with Iran, and that would make their job much more difficult in Islamabad. Add up to that, mm-hmm. that this war was not only about Iran, mm-hmm. it was about a global dynamic balance of mm-hmm. power between the West and the rest. Mm-hmm. So United States actually has started the beginning of the end of United States presence and influence in the region and perhaps in the world globally.
Mm-hmm. Now, given the Iranian experience of negotiating with the Americans, I think they must have concluded that at best the agreements with Washington won't hold, and at worst Iran will be attacked, its leaders will be assassinated, its facilities will be targeted. So what do you think are the Iranian expectations or motives as their representatives are flying to Islamabad?
Well, that's a very good question. There is a kind of absolute mistrust between the two sides. Iranians don't trust the United States because they have invaded Iran twice during the negotiations. A diplomatic kind of negotiations, and that is, prior to that, in 2018, it was Trump that withdrew from the nuclear deal without any reason. So altogether, Iranians don't trust them, and that's why something to guarantee these whatever agreements that happen, it would be very crucial for Tehran. Mm-hmm. The issue of Strait of Hormuz will be a new issue that has never been discussed before. Now is it at task? It's on the table, and also the compensation and of course the oil market. Iran has now not only control over the Strait of Hormuz but also over the price of oil and gas and the global market in one way or another mm-hmm. directly. So that altogether puts Iran in a very good position to impose its own will in Islamabad. However, the both sides should be reasonable, should be pragmatic, and should consider each other's concerns. That would be a kind of a successful approach mm-hmm. to make a kind of a lasting deal.
12 years ago, I had a chance to directly talk to President Putin of Russia as a group of journalists. And back then I asked him about navigating enmity, how to hold your ground without creating more adversity than you need. And he responded that for Russia, for him personally, that was one of the key considerations. The reason I mentioned that is because back at the time, that question was actually about Iran, because I felt that they were perhaps too rigid in their resistance to the West. But now it seems that this act of aggression has made Iran far more flexible, both in finding new means of counterattacking or, you know, responding to their enemies in asymmetrical ways, and also negotiating settlements. What do you think? Do you agree with that, that Iran perhaps now shows a much greater degree of flexibility than its enemies?
Yes, of course. I totally agree that President Trump was not wise enough to think at least about this war. He had very little information and knowledge. I don't know if he's responsible. Usually institutions around him, usually groups. But in the end of the day, it was a personal war. It was a war of choice. It was Netanyahu that dragged him into this war and made him to be a war crime. To commit a war crime in Iran from the very beginning by attacking the schoolgirls. Trump also proved that did not only miscalculated about Iran's war, that Iran was able immediately to prolong this war, to expand this war to the region, to transfer the military priority and superiority of United States into geopolitical war, into geoeconomical war, by closing the Strait of Hormuz and by to complicating the war by using asymmetrical methods in confronting United States. But also President Trump did not take into consideration. He did not only deal with an enemy and to end this enmity by destroying Iran or the regime change, but also he made new enemies. He actually proved that he cannot support, he cannot protect its allies in the region. Actually, he asked Ukraine not to target Russian and the oil facilities because of the oil price. So that shows Russia was actually selling 14% oil more than before the war with much higher price now. So this altogether, it shows that he did not have any idea about what is he doing. I'm not sure whether this war was ideological, and that's the only thing that can explain it. Otherwise, this war was not rational.
Well, but Professor, I agree with you that he's not being rational in the traditional geopolitical way, but he's also a wild card that seems to be disruptive in sometimes very positive ways. And by positive, I don't mean something that you would consciously wish for, but he is exposing that this system that we have, both global political and economic system, is based on very flimsy foundations when both a nation can attack another on an absolutely made up pretext, and that would deliver enormous repercussions to everybody around. How long do you think this current system can continue existing in such a way, and where do you think it's likely to move forward in the future?
Well, the international system does not work with someone's personal views and thinking and attitudes and personalities. There is a system that works in a very kind of usually should work in a logical way. Of course, his approach by undermining international law, it may go against him as well. His opponents globally may use the same methods for their own interests in the future and say, okay, you did it to Iran, we will do it to this and that. So that is one thing. Secondly, okay, let's say that his personality, Iranian at least, has witnessed his negative part. Let's see if in Islamabad he will show his positive side to show that he's determined and he's positive. So far, up until now, he was not so positive, simply because he did not order Netanyahu to stop the war or aggression against Lebanon. So that is undermining his positive side, even for this so-called negotiation in Islamabad. He can easily, by one tweet, stop the war in Lebanon, but he has not done it yet, and this is also a negative kind of sign for tomorrow's negotiation.
Okay, well, Professor, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this conversation in a few moments. Stay tuned.
I am on honored to have this opportunity to revisit and share the profound legacy of my father, Mwalimu Julius Nyerere. Mwalimu believed in the power of the collective spirit of the African people. His commitment to free education and health care empowered future generations. He was a champion of African unity and a committed Pan-Africanist. The relevance of my father's philosophy of ujamaa and self-reliance resonates deeply today. Mwalimu's legacy calls us to action, to own and manage our natural resources, invest in our younger generations, unite as one people, and build a prosperous Africa free from foreign control. This is our continent. The future is in our hands.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Alam Saleh, Senior Lecturer in Iranian Studies at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Professor Saleh, just before the break, we discussed some of the counterintuitive or counterproductive results of the American and Israeli attack on Iran. But, you know, clearly there's a lot of damage, both material and humanitarian damage inflicted on Iran, but at the same time, this attack handed Iran a very substantial leverage. I mean, for decades, international community has been talking about the dubious Iranian nuclear threat, but all of a sudden, it seems that Iran has much more effective tools at its disposal. I'm talking, obviously, about the blockage of the Straits of Hormuz. Do you think that leverage is going to be off the table now? Because the Iranian president said that they're not going to use it against their neighbors anymore, but it seems to be such an effective tool of policy, is it not?
Yeah, actually, you're right. There are some damages that are tactical, they're reversible, like the damages to Iran's military capabilities and civilian facilities and bridges, schools, hospitals, and so on. These are reversible. These are not are important in terms of the kind of human security, but however, in terms of strategic thinking, these are all reversible. But there are some implications, long-term strategic implications in this war that cannot be reversed. And one of them is, first of all, Iran will not be the Iran the same as Iran before the war. The region will not be the same anymore. And of course, an international dynamic will change once and forever. Let's not forget that already in the past two decades, we are witnessing the decline of Western powers. We are moving towards the less Western kind of world order. And that is, this war for sure is accelerating this transforming the West into the rest. Mm-hmm. But here, by this, I don't mean that United States is weakened now. I mean that there are kind of emerging global powers that are challenging the Western kind of dominations in the past two centuries. Mm-hmm. This war shows that even a great power like United States with over $1,000 billion military budget can be defeated militarily. And here by defeat, I don't mean that Iran defeated United States. I mean United States was not able to achieve any of his goals. So Iran was able to confront United States for 40 days. Mm-hmm. And this will raise serious questions in Moscow and Beijing mm-hmm. now, that if United States, our rival, cannot deal with Iran in 40 days, then how can you confront mm-hmm. us when it comes to your biggest mm-hmm. challenges in Europe mm-hmm. and in Asia?
Well, Professor, I think it also shows to many countries around the world that regardless of how strong or big is your military, without a thoughtful strategy, it's not worth much, both in strategic terms and in terms of, you know, immediate operations. I heard you say before that Iran has been successful in using what you call the balance of threats to offset this balance of power that the United States and Israel may have counted on. And I think one way of doing that, that Iran has clearly shown to all of us, is expanding or weaponizing geography of this conflict, making sure that, you know, Western allies see the backside of the proxy politics and of the alliance. Do you think the structure of Western alliances or American alliances will remain intact going forward?
No, of course, this will change the dynamics of power kind of relations between United States and even its allies. We heard that one of some of his closest allies telling him no during the war when he asked their help. NATO said no, European powers said no to him. Even Asian partners like South Korea said no to him. So that for sure shows the weaknesses of this kind of approach. This is one of the things that we learn from this war is that kind of a heavy reliance on military power does not necessarily lead to war, to victory, sorry. And as you've just mentioned, I've discussed this before, that this war is not a balance of power. Yes, of course, there is no balance of power by all means between Iran and United States, not to mention Israel. But there is a balance of threats. So states like Iran can use asymmetrical methods using geography, geopolitics, and time to confront United States. Mm-hmm. And we know that now that they've been successful in this strategic mm-hmm. kind of war strategy mm-hmm. to deal with the threats that United States and Israel impose mm-hmm. on Iran.
Now, I heard you say in another interview that you believe that this conflict ultimately goes beyond Iran and that it's aimed at the entire structure of the Middle East. Do you think the regional actors understand that? And do their interests align with the Israeli or American views on this?
Yes, they knew this even before the war. That's why all regional powers, actually neighboring countries, have done their best to stop President Trump to enter this war, but he did so. He neglected them all, and he listened to Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister, only. And this is now it puts these countries, especially Arab Gulf countries, in a very, very severe kind of and difficult situation to be in between Iran as a regional power now and United States that is reluctant to accomplish its job and to make a mess and leave them alone and just ask the international community to deal with the Strait of Hormuz. This shows that there was there wasn't a strategy to deal with Iran, but also there was no power to deal with it. So altogether, it creates a new security architecture in the Middle East that all countries in the Middle East needs a new prescription to deal with the new kind of circumstances and issues. This would undermine kind of completely the so-called traditionally established kind of security dynamic of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about those new old actors, the emergence of Pakistan, or rather the Pakistani military establishment as both a mediator and a host for the U.S.-Iranian talks is quite interesting. What do you make of it?
Well, of course, after what happened in the past 40 days, Arab countries were not able or in a position to mediating between Iran and United States. Pakistan is close to China and also close to America and also close to Tehran. And as a result, it was a good choice. They don't have much experience in the past to mediate between countries since early 1970s when they have dealt with the United States and China. However, we know that they are in a good position. And at the end of the day, it's not about who mediates. It's about Tehran and Washington to reach the point that, okay, there is no kind of coercive solution for this confrontation. Mm-hmm. Let's sit and talk and deal with the issue as it is today.
Mm-hmm. Now, even if these U.S.-Iranian talks are successful, there is still Israel with its pretty aggressive regional stance. How would you assess its positioning at this point of time, and how is it likely to behave if Washington and Tehran manage to reach some tentative agreement?
Well, it was very obvious from the very beginning that the goals of Israel for this war was were very different from the United States, and they both were in the same war, however, with different kind of interests, with different views on this war. We know that in the end of the day, if United States seriously and seriously here, I mean, honestly, wanted to reach the deal with Iran, they can control Israel easily. In the end of the day, the United States, Israel alone cannot confront Iran. We saw, actually, Israel and the United States could not defeat Iran, so Israel alone will not be able to do so. However, we know that the Israeli lobby is important and is strong, and as a result, they will, through United States, they try to impose some of their views and their interests on the negotiation table. Otherwise, Israel alone cannot act independently from United States in dealing with Iran now. Mm-hmm.
You have written before that, quote, history suggests that great powers often decline not solely due to external threat, but also because of overextension. And it seems that Donald Trump was aware of this overreach danger when he ran for office and during his first term. Do you think he's still wary of overextension, regardless of what he says? Do you think he's likely to learn from this crisis not to get bogged down yet again?
Well, I think it's not only about Trump's problem. It's the United States is addicted to use coercive means to deal with issues, so with the political issues. So they prefer a coercive approach towards diplomatic issues. So that's what he called it, a coercive diplomacy. And actually, this mentality, this mindset should change. We're living in the 21st century, and a developing country like Iran can confront United States easily somehow, yes. Within 40 days, they cannot defeat Iran. So therefore, actually, we have other examples that great powers like United States actually have been defeated in Vietnam. In Vietnam, the 2 million ton of bombs have been used against the Vietnamese, and finally, they were being United States were defeated. In Afghanistan in 2020, they were defeated badly too. So this mentality, this approach, this kind of authoritative approach towards the others should change. And this is not kind of peculiar to President Trump. We've seen that all other presidents in the past few decades have used coercive means, whereas they could solve the problem easily diplomatically. So now I think this might be one of the last lessons that United States learns, that okay, the international dynamic is changing. The rest of the world are emerging as power, and they have their own independence. They don't need the West anymore desperately like in the past two centuries. Now they are economically powerful, militarily powerful. They have political alternatives like BRICS, like Shanghai Organization Operation, and so on. They don't need to rely on us only.
Absolutely, and I think they also have mental and analytical ability to learn from American mistakes. Hopefully, Washington can also develop that skill. Anyway, Professor Salih, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.